todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. My guest today is Alison Rouse, best known as the woman who was with The Who's John Entwistle when he passed away here in Las Vegas, Nevada in 2002. She has written her memoir, We've Got Tonight, The Life and Times of a Notorious Groupie, and she currently hosts Cocktails and Rocktails, in which she dishes on the two decades she spent waking up next to the most infamous rock stars in music history. She also has on the occasional guest, and I was one of them just this week. Alison has some great stories and perspectives on the groupie lifestyle, so without further ado, let's get her on the line now. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast, Alison.
Thank you for having me, Stacey. I'm really, truly excited to be here, as you know.
Yes. Let's start with telling everyone who's listening how we connected. So, you read one of my books, Rock and Roll Nightmares, True Stories, Volume 2, which covered John Entwistle's passing, and corrected me for misquoting you through one of my sources of research. And I was happy to make that correction because I do strive for accuracy. Would you mind telling our readers how that tabloid story has affected your life in the ensuing years?
Oh, absolutely. And thank you so much for being such a gracious, lovely woman for changing that for me. I can't even tell you how much I appreciate it. But I think it's not just that tabloid story that affected my life. It's so many others of the domino effect of rumors that I had going with it, because I'm just constantly on guard. You find a whole different way to be protective about yourself and put a wall up. So yeah, it definitely affected me in that manner. You know, I get very defensive sometimes.
And that was never your intention when you were seeing John, right? I mean, you weren't looking for the spotlight. Sadly, he passed away when you were with him.
Yeah, no, was never looking for the spotlight. I mean, that was 17 years into my rock and roll lifestyle and 13 years into our relationship that happened. And yeah, just sort of ran with it, really. Just, you know, what are you going to do? You wake up and you just kind of go with the flow, I guess.
Your memoir, We've Got Tonight, includes a fascinating piece of correspondence, a personal apology letter from Roger Daltrey regarding calling you a prostitute in the press. Now, it seemed genuine to me, but what was the story behind all that?
Well, I just kind of got to, because Roger knew that was never a title to put on me, because that was never a job that I had. Roger's kind of very cheeky and mouthy. I call him a shire dwelling mouth jockey because he's short. But it was the only way, because I never knew him off stage. They don't hang out off stage. They're not the best of friends off stage. So you don't connect with them. My friend Danny knew him 1,000 years ago. But so the only way I could tell him to shut up and quit calling me that was to call my lawyer. John's best friend, Cy Langston, who was also his personal assistant, still worked for the Who even after John passed. Roger wasn't too happy about it, according to Cy, and he was really mad that he had to pay my lawyer. I didn't ask for anything for myself, except for the public apology, retraction, and personal apology, and pay a lawyer on the way out.
Right.
But he was really mad about the cost of it and that he had to go back on his own words. And it was a gracious letter, but the signature was angry.
Oh, okay. Well, you're better than anyone can read between the lines on that one. How did you first meet John, and what made you two connect?
It was backstage at Boulder, Colorado in 1989. It was 2 weeks before my 19th birthday. And we had some friends that were working out on the Who. Sweet Sweet Connie from, the song, Connie Hamsey, was out on the road with them. They're like, we want these two worlds to clash, the old school groupie with the new school groupies. So we ended up just meeting him up in Colorado. I knew I wanted John, and that's what I did. It was just like, saw him doing sound check. I'm like, there we are.
Oh. Well, one of the things that I really enjoyed most about your book is your sense of humor, your way with words. I have to say, I was laughing out loud a few times. I want to read this one passage that really I thought was great. So you're talking about meeting Stephen Piercy of Rat, and you said, I could not believe I was standing here so close to the man that was making my little girl hormones do a pole dance in my panties. It's so fun. I mean, it really paints a picture and makes us feel like you were feeling. So, how did you develop your voice as a writer, though, for that book, which is over 500 pages long?
Well, it really is just my sense of humor, my sarcasm. I really just sat down. I, like you had asked if I kept journals in the questions, and I did, but I just took out my scrapbooks with all my passes, tossed them down, opened up the first one, and started writing.
Oh,
Just
wow.
remembering and my sense of humor, and things just sort of, as you're writing, and sometimes things just pop into your head and you put them down, you're like, okay, I hope that works.
One thing that I did want to ask you was, so if you didn't keep journals, so just seeing those passes and the photographs really jogged your memory?
Oh
I mean,
yeah.
because you have
I
led quite a full life. I mean, I don't know how you can remember all that.
Well, I did keep journals, but they were packed away, so I just didn't feel like digging through the boxes to find them. But yeah, like I said, I just looked down, and Danny, one of the other girls from the book that's very prominent, she and I were partners in crime. She remembered stuff like, I didn't remember I slept with Toby Keith. He just came on the radio. I'm like, I would have liked to slept with Toby Keith. She's like, you did. I was like, I thought that was someone else. So it was a combination of, surprisingly, I have a really good memory, and the other girls kind of reminding me as things went along.
Right, and you never really partook a lot in the drugs, and I mean, I know you drank from time to time, but it was nothing like some of the rock stars who I don't even know how they remember to write their memoirs.
I don't know how anybody from the 80s knows that remembered anything to write the memoirs.
I know, right? Yeah, it's crazy. Actually, I did read Stephen Piercy's memoir. I listened to the audiobook and it was pretty wild and out there. But your expectation versus the reality was a little bit different, wasn't it?
It was because you go in with all these like starry ideas and everything, and then you beat the reality. But quite honestly, I really like the reality better, even if it did smell like Stephen Pearson's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as he put it in his book.
Oh, well, I hope that David Lee Roth was a little better aroma-wise because you lost your virginity to David Lee Roth. What was it about him that made you choose him to be the one? Because that's a big thing for a girl.
Yeah, opportunity, actually. And I, like I described in the book, I was part of the Masons. There's a female side to the Masonic Temple that people don't know about. And you start at 12 years old as Rainbow Girls. And as you grow, you move through the ranks. You become the head debutante by the time you're like 16, 17. And you go out to the nationwide and statewide convention. So we were at a statewide convention without my parents. Van Halen happened to be staying at our hotel while they were promoting 1984. And of course, you got David Lee Roth, the hottest, blondest lead singer in the world at the moment. And he plopped down and says, hey, you want a drink? I'm like,
Yeah, can you ex tell the readers? I encourage everyone to read the book though, because it's fantastic and it's so much fun, and all your stories are wild and enviable in some ways, some not so much. But
Yeah.
can you tell those who are listening, because I know you were born in the Ozarks and then you moved to Utah. So can you give us just a little brief rundown of how you became a groupie and where you're from?
I was actually born in New Mexico, moved to
Oh, okay.
Missouri when I was 6 years old, lived there for 9 years. And like I said, met David Lee Roth right before my mom and dad got a divorce in about 1984-ish, 85-ish. And yeah, just happened to meet him. Then we moved to Salt Lake City, which that summer, right after that, which was the groupie capital of the world at the time. And just sort
Oh.
of happened upon it. My first concert saw these two girls dressed in their regalia heading toward the back. So I'm like, all right, who are they? Where are they going? Where are they going? And, I mean, just meeting Van Halen at the hotel really somehow made sense to me. You know, it just felt like, okay, this is where I belong.
Yeah, were you aware of? I know that you had mentioned in your book that you saw groupies on the show Real People, which kind of like jogged my memory too. I was like, oh my God, I remember that show. But did
You
you had,
do.
huh?
You do remember that
I do. Yeah. I mean, we all watched that show. Did you know about groupies before that? Had you heard of Pamela DeBar or any of those sort of famous groupies prior to that show?
No, not at all. I mean, I was probably 12 years old when that show happened, so wasn't really aware of anything like that. I was aware of the 8-track tapes that I had, and I was so in love with Paul McCartney, and I knew at 16 I was just gonna go be with him. And I didn't know what it was. It was just this thing in my head telling me, you're gonna be around these people. And yeah, instead of just looking at the album covers, it's like, okay, that's the one I'm gonna. So it's just some weird natural instinct that I can't even explain.
Do you remember what the first album you bought was?
Oh yeah, Sean Cassidy.
Oh yeah.
All
Yeah, it was like Leif Garrett, Sean Cassidy, all those pretty boys from the
Rex
70s.
Smith.
Yeah. Yes, Sooner or Later. Remember that movie?
Yep, and I was trying to watch it because somebody suggested it, so I went to go watch it. You can't find it anywhere.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it was because she was actually 16 when she filmed it, and he was 24, so it's considered kind of
Uh-oh.
taboo.
Oh, they made it go away. Well, that's, yeah, things have changed quite a bit. In fact, that kind of leads me to one of my other questions, which is that it's, you know, the Me Too movement started happening in 2017, and a lot of people were coming out of the woodwork decades later to say, oh, I was abused. What do you, as you look back on it, what do you think of the so-called baby groupie scene, which was really big in the 70s? And what do you think? I mean, I know that Steven Tyler's ex-girlfriend, she even lived with him as a teenager. It's not like there was one encounter and she sued him in a Me Too lawsuit, which was actually dismissed. But what are your thoughts on that with young girls and rock stars?
I really think it is because I was so young when I met my first rock star, but it was for me a choice that I was never manipulated in. But like in LA, and you lived in LA, you know this, everybody wants to be somewhere, somebody, something. They're doing whatever they can to get their leg up. And with like Sable Starr and Lori Maddox, I think they were heavily used by Rodney Bingenheimer, Kim Fowley, just like the ladies in The Runaways, you know. So there was more of a sinister thing there. And I definitely think Steven Tyler's ex-girlfriend time, parents were a lot more, they gave a lot more leeway. They were a lot more lenient with that stuff. I mean, we were on our own from 6 years old. We're the feral generation. And I think that they were like, oh, it's a rock star. They're going to take care of my daughter and then she's going to live this great life. But you don't count on the callousness and the selfishness of these men at that age, especially because they were just themselves in their 20s. Just starting to live this life and told that they were the gods and nothing that they could do is wrong. And I think she was definitely a victim. And if somebody was victimized or taken advantage of or whatever atrocity, I definitely 100% stand behind them. Unfortunately, that's just not my story.
Yeah, no, I'm glad it wasn't your story. You know, you definitely were a free agent and you never felt like you were manipulated or abused because you were going to these hotels and you wanted to spend time with these guys. But yeah, I guess it's a case by case basis. It's hard to say. Like, I know that Bob Dylan also had a lawsuit that was dismissed, but this woman seemed to be a little unhinged anyway. But, to go back like 60 years, I don't know how a court can even process a lawsuit from that long ago.
Well, it really depends on, the story being consistent, which, Steven Tyler's girlfriend, everybody who was around Kim Pally or Robert B Rob Roddy Bingenheimer, a lot of the same story, a lot of the same. So how can you really go wrong? Because is it mass memory? No, I don't think so. I think it's just, and especially at the time when women were not given a safe place to come out, and it took all those years to have a safe place.
That's true. Yeah, that's another aspect of it. And also, I'm sure that nowadays it would not be allowed to have these rock musicians literally take legal guardianship over these girls, even if their parents did allow it, like with Ted Nugent and of course Steven Tyler as well.
And I was going to say Ted Nugent, because Steven Tyler, okay, he kind of moved on from that phase of his life, which it wasn't right when it happened. But then you have Ted Nugent or Jimmy Page who stay in that phase of their life. Those are the two guys, in my opinion, that need a little help,
Right. Yeah, I have a chapter about baby groupies in one of my books, and it was like, where's Jimmy Page gonna go next, to a fetus? I mean, it's like they keep getting younger and younger. Yeah, it's
You'd be
wild.
surprised. Several women have reached out to me on my channel saying, yeah, I met Jimmy Page at a hotel. I was in a cafe with, I was 13, I was 14, and we're talking into the 1980s, the 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, while some of your wildest stories involve being filmed, which was such a novelty in the 80s and 90s with the advent of the home video camera, I know that you have this under the stage story
Oh,
with
yeah.
Def Leppard, which is really funny. I thought it was hilarious. And then your on stage moment with Tone Loc. So have you ever seen those recordings, or have they surfaced yet? I always
I
say
have
yet
seen
because you
the
never
ones
know.
from underneath Def Leppard stage, because their tour manager Ian, who is also Metallica's tour manager, he was ever present with, and you know what I mean by the video camera holding it up here on your shoulder.
Yeah.
And he always promised they'll be safe, we'll keep him in the family, and he lives in Japan, so I don't think they'll ever get imported over to here, because he has tons and tons of hours of years of videotape with all these guys, every under the stage of Def Leppard, everything. Now the
Wow.
Tone Loc one, that was filmed for MTV,
Okay.
and Danny and I've tried to find it. We cannot find it, but oh gosh.
Well, it's like, after Hugh Hefner passed away, no one really knows what happened to all those videotapes. I think he had thousands of them, and it's like they're out there somewhere. We don't know.
Oh, you know somebody from that mansion took something.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, all those stories are coming out now. Well, you mentioned Connie Hamsey earlier, and for those who don't know, she was in the Grand Funk Railroad's song, We're an American band, Sweet Sweet Connie, doing her act. So you met her on a Who tour stop. So she kept going well into middle age. I know that she was still breaking in young rock stars when she was older, apparently. What are your thoughts on those who've made it kind of a lifelong pursuit?
Well, is it so much of a lifelong pursuit? And I really felt this with Connie, because it's the same with myself. It's the social circle, our second family, where we so feel safe. We feel ourselves. We don't feel judged. We don't feel degraded. We have a reality with these guys, so why would we go anywhere else? Like, I still have friends, in the music business that I go out and see all the time. We have dinner. It's not crazy wild party till the sun comes up anymore. It's dinner, drinks. We're all home by midnight, 1 o'clock at the very latest. So like I said, I think if you're home with your second family, why not? You stay friends with them for life, and that's really all it is.
In the world of rock, with its dangerous elements, for life may not always be as long as it could have been otherwise. And
No.
yeah, I mean, you've lost John Entwistle and Vinnie Paul of Pantera. I know you were also very close to. So you kind of had to go through a lot more death than someone else in a different kind of lifestyle. How does that shape you as a person over the years?
I think really when you're with the band and you're out on the road, you feel so protected, untouchable on tour. You're in this protected world behind bodyguards, behind gates, behind this, behind that. You're very, very separated. So you think you're invincible. So when it does happen, like that was the first time in 17 years when John passed away that something like that had happened. And then you have a situation where Vinnie Paul with the crazy fan, who had schizophrenia. So you don't realize just what the dangers really are. They invade your space and it does change you when it happens because you're like, oh my God, obviously John changed my life completely. And with Vin, his life was changed. He became a totally different person. And yeah, I had to give up some of my dreams, some of what I thought what I was going to do because I felt like I didn't have that protection anymore. It's like all of a sudden I was this novelty and the one to blame, So yeah, it definitely changes you because not only do you mourn and like especially with Vincent Paul, part piece of my heart went with him. And I'll never be the same without him. It's like I still think, God, I wish I could just go, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah. Does it make you feel more cautious or more like, life is short, I should live it to the fullest?
I think a bit of both, a bit of both. Because when I was younger, I saw so many people going down the drug spirals without dying, that affected me. I didn't want to be that. And then after John, everything, it was like, with Glenn Tipton, I was also seeing him at the time, and he was doing the stuff, same stuff that John had done. And I was furious about it. I was just not going to tolerate it anymore. I didn't want it around me anymore. And he was friends with John, and that was the last night he did that stuff because I ran him up a tree and down the other side.
I think that your book gives fans an inside look at, some of the personality behind the guitar, the drum kit. It's very interesting in that way too. Now, what's one of the biggest misconceptions you feel that people have about groupie culture, that you'd like to either correct or speak about?
I think that so many just general, in general, people think we're just disposable, that we don't have the kind of connections that we do, that we don't have the kind of friendships, the kind of camaraderie that we do. And I think because, with the movie like Rockstar, it shows the 80s groupies, especially standing in lines, wanting to see, be with that lead singer one right after the other. That was never a reality. So you kind of fight and, people still kind of treat you very degradingly while saying, oh, but he was my favorite rocker. You're like, well, but if he was standing here in front of you, he wouldn't allow you to treat me like that. But people feel emboldened because of what their perception for movies and stuff, and I think that's really important for people to know that we are women that made our own choices, especially the 80s ladies. We came from mothers who were able to have their own apartments for the first time, to have their own freedom for the very first time in history, and we were the daughters of that. So it wasn't the rock stars always pursuing us, it was the 80s ladies kicking in that door and saying, ha, we're here.
In the 1960s and 70s, there was the advent of the pill and the sexual revolution, plus the rise of rock music, which kind of makes the groupie scenes in those eras unique. What makes your era of the 1980s and 90s unique?
Well, we owned it in a totally different way. The 70s groupies were still kind of the trinkets of the band. And when it came to the 80s, we were so empowered and emboldened, bold, that, like I said, we kicked down the rock star's door and we were like, yeah, you are our candy store now. Hold on, I'll get to you in a minute,
That's great. Well, what are some of the good things, or the best surprises that you've had from putting your story out there? Because we talked about the downside with the tabloids and the misinformation, but what are some of the best, sort of overflow from having your book out now?
Just all the other amazing women that I've got to meet, like yourself, like the other groupies that I've been able to interview and hear that, the how much similarities we've had. And just the family that I've created there, it feels so much like an 80s rock show when we all still were off of our phones with our lighters, everybody passing whatever in the crowd, sitting on shoulders. You don't see that anymore. And I just am so lucky that I get to meet those people. We get to still have that vibe. So without a doubt, just the other human beings I get to meet through it have been absolute pleasure.
Well, you do have some books that are instructional for groupies who may want to dive into the lifestyle or maybe even just see what it could be like. But how do you think that social media has changed that? Because I feel like that could be a double-edged sword. We feel like we have more access than ever before, but maybe we don't. Maybe, it stars are a little more cautious about putting themselves in the path of fans face to face.
And then, like you said, there everybody's so much more cautious. Everybody's kind of very much got the wall of protection up because, when we were living our hedonism in the 80s, especially in Salt Lake City, we're behind the Zion curtain. Nobody knew. We didn't have camera. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have social media. We were able to live such more of a free lifestyle. And now you can't because you could get in trouble. You could get degraded. You could, get stalkers. It's such a different world. You don't live as vicariously without the privacy as you did then.
But what is the groupie style like nowadays?
I when I still go out with my friends and we have dinner, everything is so much more mellow, but I rarely see like a real groupie out there with them that's from this era. And I would love to see that because it's become, especially since, the COVID and everything that shut down, we became this big bubble, and that bubble has just become much more thicker and too serious. It's too business controlled, and it's not the heart and soul of rock and roll anymore. That's what the road used to be. And I think we need to bring that back, to be quite honest.
Yeah, that sense of fun feels a bit like it's gone now. It's more like a grind where it's so hard to even make a living as a musician. It's probably not as joyous anymore, from their side.
No, I see some of the faces on the road. In fact, I just, Def Leppard was through, and a couple of my friends were working. I had a girl who had I met through the channel in town, and we went up to the hotel, and I just, yeah, they were so, like, it took a couple of the guys to recognize me because one of them used to work for the Who, and it took him a minute to recognize me, but they were so standoffish at first before they recognized me, and that made me sad because it was. That's never how it used to be. It's like you'd see your people at the hotel bar, they'd be like, ladies. And everybody was so welcoming and excited to meet new people. And now it's like, oof, don't come near me type of thing,
I mean, it's so easy to get canceled these days. It's such a
Yeah.
strange atmosphere, I guess, when it comes to the freewheeling lifestyle of a rocker. Although I feel like that, lawsuits aside, the few that I've seen, that it really hasn't hit the rock world quite like it has the Hollywood world.
No, I mean, you have P. Diddy, you have all those others and stuff. And yeah, I mean, Jimmy Page is still skirting free. You know what I mean? There's a lot of rockers that are skirting free, except for, well, Gary Glitter. He got hit what he deserved,
Well, that's without question someone who
And
should be behind bars.
yeah,
But
and
in
I think, it's like it's not as easy to get away with things like we did with our fake IDs back in the day. So you're gonna have people that are more legitimate, they don't have that fear over it. I think they, the rock world should welcome that laughter back in.
I agree. Well, your book is funny, so people can read that. And tell me about your other books, which I touched on briefly, and your podcast.
Well, my other books are just silly little 10, 20 page books to be like where you can meet the rock stars, what not to do, what you can't do. Don't be so preoccupied. And it's just because a lot of girls ask me, how do I meet the band? It hasn't changed, the hotel bar. Don't get so lost in your head that this is how it's going to go. I want that lead singer. I think I wrote it mainly just to kind of bring people out of their own heads and to kind of give them a little laughter and a little insight of how to do it. People are a lot more cautious. It's just like everybody's kind of become so introverted, which was never the rock and roll I knew.
It's a different era. Now, what about your show, Cocktails and Rocktails?
It's just a fun little thing. I started out, my friend Jen, she was Virgil Howe was her ex-husband, and it's when her father-in-law, I believe, was in Yes or another band like that. She was a model, and she just happened to read my book, and she reached out to me. We became friends, and she's like, "You need to do this. Get off your hidey and do this." So, because of Jen, I ended up doing it, and I was like, "Well, I can't just talk about my book because that's going to run out. So, where do I go next?" I give opinions from someone who was actually there. I'm not, we both know that there's a lot of AI content that gets it wrong, that just is there for clicks and cash. They have five different channels,
Oh, yeah. For those listening, where can they find your show?
Just on YouTube at Cocktails and Rocktails. And
All
I'm
right.
up every Thursday and Sunday.
Now, my exit question here on the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast is always, what is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
Well, I lived it in June of 2002 with Las Vegas.
Yes,
You
you
wake up to it, and like I said, this, my friend, my lover, this person who I had immense love and respect for, didn't wake up, and it's just like, is this really happening? It's, you don't think about it because, like I said, you feel so protected on tour, but then it happens. You're like, yeah, this is the real rock and roll nightmare, and the domino effects that's been going for 22 years. So yeah, there it is.
Oh gosh, yeah. Well, for those who would like to get that whole story, it's in your book, which is available on Amazon. And it's an ebook. That's how I read it, was an ebook. And is it in paperback as well?
Yes, it's available, but in all the avenues at Amazon, the ebook, the hard copy, the paperback, and the Audible.
All right. Oh, you got Audible too. I love
Yeah,
audiobooks. All right.
I do too.
Well,
That's how I listen to yours, and I'm so excited. And
yeah.
thank you again for sending me the vampire ones. I'm truly excited.
Oh yeah, I bet you'll
And I
like
even told
them.
my niece about it because she loves all the vampire books. I had to turn
Oh
her on to
sweet.
the Anne Rice ones from, the Twilight series, because I'm like, no, girl, get over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a little more rock and roll with my vampires. But well, thanks again, Allison. It was really great to chat with you, and you're welcome back anytime. And thanks
Thank
again.
you. I'd love to come up anytime you see it. It's so, again, nice to meet you. And thank you for coming on mine, because you guys, she's going to be on mine. I'll get you up tomorrow and Sunday.
Oh, sweet. All right. Bye, Allison.
All right, bye. Take care.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.